Scandinavians are known for their design, but few are as well known as Bjarke Ingels. Although he's under 40, he has been dubbed architecture's It Boy, listed as among the first rank of international architects by The New Yorker. His provocative designs in Europe focus on sustainability and range from a waste-to-energy plant with a ski slope for a roof to a mountain-shaped apartment building set atop an above-ground parking garage. And now Bjarke Ingels has come to the United States. His first project is underway along Manhattan's West Side Highway, and he's recently chosen to redesign the Smithsonian's campus on the National Mall. I'm very pleased to welcome him to our show. Hello.
Hello.
You've said that we tend to have a Protestant view of sustainability. What do you mean by that?
It's because I think quite often sustainability has been seen as this sort of, in the light of this sort of Protestant idea that it has to hurt to do good, almost as if sustainability is a question of how much of our quality of life we actually prepare to sacrifice in order to afford becoming sustainable. And I think there's a lot of examples where sustainable cities and buildings actually increase the quality of life.
But you've coined the term hedonistic sustainability that suggests going even further.
Exactly. Like I think one of the good examples is like a city like Copenhagen. The industrial port has become so clean that you can actually swim in it. So that means you don't have to sit for hours to go to the Hamptons. You can actually jump in the middle of the port, in the middle of the city.
And how has that been achieved?
It's like very simple investments that you... That there were some investments in making a drainage on the surface of the former sort of piers, and very quickly the water became clean.
So could we do that with New York Harbor?
I think it's actually a big harbor. I know that already people do swim in the Hudson, so I think it's definitely in the process.
Earlier this month, you broke ground on a radical new waste energy plant in Copenhagen. Can you describe it?
Yeah, essentially it is 97% of the Copenhageners get all of their heating, and Copenhagen is a cold city, all of their heating as excess heat from the power production. And essentially this power plant is going to transform garbage into district heating and electricity. And it's going to be the biggest and tallest building in all of Copenhagen. So we thought instead of making a big ugly box that casts shadows on the neighbors and blocks the views, to actually turn it into a man-made mountain. And we have snow in Copenhagen, but the city is completely flat. So we have to go to Sweden or the Alps to ski. And from 2016, you'll actually be able to do alpine skiing in the middle of Copenhagen on the roof of the power plant.
How many people can ski at the same time?
It's the size of like a smallish ski resort. So you can have a couple of hundred people on the slopes.
So is this a moneymaker as well?
It is actually going to sort of carry itself, and I think it's a quite interesting sort of a example of a synergy between radically different activities. It actually happens that the first ski slopes and ski lifts in the world were mining lifts that used to drag silver down from the mountains, and then when the silver mines ran out, the industry went bankrupt, and somebody got the idea to reverse the flow and drag skiers up the mountain. So you can say, like, we always know how to reinvent the infrastructure of the past to become the framework of the culture and leisure of the present. But in this case, we're actually doing it proactively. We're not waiting for the power plant to decommission. We're skiing on it while it's already running.
How do you deal with the carbon dioxide that's released by the power plant?
It actually happens that this is going to be the cleanest waste-to-energy power plant in the entire world. But there's still some CO2 emissions. So like the smoke coming out is completely non-toxic, but there's still some CO2 emissions. And as a way of creating awareness, together with Realities United out of Berlin and Artist Group, we designed the mouth of the chimney so that it accumulates CO2. And when there's 400 pounds of CO2, it puffs a gigantic smoke ring. And of course, on one hand, it has to do with making something that used to be a problem, pollution, into something harmless and playful. But also what it does is that you can say, like, knowledge is the main driver for behavioral change. If people don't know, they can't act. And nobody knows what a ton of CO2 is. It's ungraspable. It's abstract. But if you come to Copenhagen in 16, if you look at the skies, you'll be able to count smoke rings. And when you counted five of them, we just emitted one ton of CO2.
When you designed the Danish pavilion for the Shanghai World Expo, you ran into some opposition from what you've described as Denmark's version of the Tea Party. What happened?
It was because we were trying to advocate this idea of hedonistic sustainability. So we were bringing clean water so the Chinese could experience how it is to swim in the middle of the city. We were bringing the city bikes of Denmark so they could bike through the pavilion, also making it a perfect museum for impatient people because you could go through the whole exhibition in just 2 minutes. And then we were thinking, how are we going to get the Chinese to come here? And then we saw in the public school curriculum of China, they have 3 fairy tales by Hans Christian Andersen, including The Little Mermaid. And The Little Mermaid is like the Statue of Liberty of Copenhagen. So we thought, why don't we bring the actual Little Mermaid, not a copy or replica, but the actual mermaid to China for 6 months, so all of the Chinese that grew up with the mermaid could actually see her in real life. And then the Nationalist Party freaked out.
Taking away our city symbol.
Yeah, exactly. They tried to pass a law specifically against moving the mermaid, so I had to go to Parliament to argue her case.
So architecture can also become a political issue. Did that apply when you designed the new city hall for Tallinn, the capital of Estonia?
Yeah, in all our work, we really try to deal with the public realm in different ways. And for Tallinn, we had to do a public building, the home of the democracy. And all city halls in old European cities have a little tower with a spire on it. So we made the city council a very, very tall ceiling space with a sloping roof. And then we made the ceiling out of mirror. So when the politicians have to make difficult decisions, they look up in the ceiling and it becomes a periscope. And they get an overview of the city that they're messing with. But as a side effect...
I like the fact you said messing with, yes.
Exactly. And as a side effect, the people can then, in return, when they get unhappy with what's happening at City Hall and go to demonstrate, they can look straight into the tower and get a perfect overview of the city council. They can see if politicians are sleeping or doing dirty deals, playing angry phones.
My guest is Bjarke Ingels. He's an architect. His company is called Big Bjarke Ingels Group. You have received the American Institute of Architecture Honor Award and the European Prize for Architecture, so I guess we shouldn't be surprised that people have decided to invite you to design here. What are you working on?
Right now we are working on trying to sort of create almost like a hybrid between a typical Copenhagen courtyard and the sort of New York skyscraper. We're working on a project nicknamed the Durst Pyramid on West 57th Street on the west side of Manhattan.
On the West Side Highway.
Exactly. And it's in a way bringing a small central park, the scale of a city block, into the heart of the block and gives all of the residents like their own little urban oases in the middle of the city.
Do you know how much the apartments in this building are going to cost? Does that concern you?
They're going to be rental apartments, but actually 20% of them are going to be affordable.
Now, designers sometimes complain that building codes and money-minded developers make it difficult to build innovative projects in New York City. Have you encountered any of that kind of resistance?
Yeah, like everybody told me actually to beware that this was like the strictest building rules in the world, and like the developers were only thinking about profits. All developers have to worry about making money; otherwise, they're not going to be developers for a long time. So I think in a way, all the issues are like same, but different. I think one thing I have to say: it's much easier to do a high rise in New York. Because in Copenhagen, the tallest typical building is 5 floors. So I think, each climate, each context has its own unique opportunities.
What about the Smithsonian? They just hired you to redesign the campus and the National Mall. Now, there are already buildings there. And what will you be doing? Changing where the trees are?
It's got to be a little bit of almost like an architectural exercise in archaeology. Because some of the things that you don't see and a lot of people miss is actually that there is like huge exhibition spaces underground. And what we've been asked to do by the Smithsonian is look at trying to make some of the treasures that are now buried deep in the soil of Washington, D.C., try to make them more available and sort of blatantly visible for people passing by.
But everything has to be green in the way that you think.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, our cities are not the way they are because they have to be. It's simply, you know, we built them ourselves, and this is how far we got. So if we want to change things, if we want to ask more from our environment, if we want to turn our waste into energy, if we want to ski on the roof of our power plants, we actually have not only the power and the skills, but also the responsibility to make sure that it happens.
Well, the reason we have such undistinguished architecture, it seems to me, is that anything that goes beyond the obvious is expensive. So how do you convince people to spend more money?
I mean, I think it's more a question of trying to kill as many birds with one stone as possible. If you're going to, like, pour some concrete, if you're going to put up some windows, you might as well do it in a way that it actually sort of creates qualities, not only for the people that are going to live there, but also for the city around it. You can say maybe it's only 1% of a city that's actually public. The rest is made on some kind of a private initiative. And if all of these buildings only mind their own business, eventually we'll live in a very, very boring city. Whereas if each time you have an opportunity to do something, you also make sure that you check off some of the items on everybody else's wish list, and eventually we'll live in the city we dream about.
Are you surprised that you're doing your work here and in Washington rather than in Chicago, which is the architecture loving city of America?
I mean, I think you know, for all architects, New York is somehow the ultimate city. But we are actually right now in the process of hopefully doing a project in Chicago. So we're catching up. I think one thing.
Are you going to base yourself in the United States now?
I actually moved here 2.5 years ago. I'm the happy holder of a green card. But I think America is quite amazing in the sense that when we got announced as the architects of the Smithsonian project, the Washington Business Review called me, like just mentioned me as Danish-born Bjarke Ingels. And I really like that because it says a lot about America that I got off the plane 2.5 years ago, and now my Danishness is some interesting thing about my past, and I really love that. It's a very welcoming culture.
Well, we have embraced artists over the years. There are an awful lot of artists who were emigres, often chased out of Europe during World War II or before World War II, who are now described as American artists. So someday we're going to start calling you an American architect. Are the architects in your firm mostly Danish? Because there is a Danish approach to design, isn't there?
I think, you know, we are actually, I think, 26 different nationalities. Here in the U.S. office, we are 60 people and three of us are Danish. But I think what has brought us together is this idea that architecture can also be a way to secure social concerns, environmental performance, and not only just some kind of two-dimensional aesthetic composition.
Well, I warn you that if you come up with an idea for a ski slope in a building in New York, climate change may very well make that not the best idea. A few years back, that would have been a pretty good idea. But I'm so pleased to welcome you to the United States. And this apartment building, do we have any sense of when it's going to be completed on the West Side Highway?
It should be a quite striking part of the West Side skyline in December 2015.
Before you go, do you see yourself as part of a larger trend in architecture?
Yeah, I mean, I think you do see a tendency that that a city like New York, whose skyline is a product of. I hear music coming.
Yeah, it means we got to talk fast.
Yeah, exactly. so let me answer in a quicker way. I think we're definitely onto something that I think is worth pursuing, not only for us.
Bjarke Ingels, his company, Big Bjarke Ingels Group, thank you so much for being on our show.
It's a pleasure.